case, Ms. Arvalo versus Coloplast Corporation. Morning, counsel.
Good morning, your honors, and may it please the court. I'm Thomas Burns, and I represent Michelle Arvalo. Ordinarily, Daubert vests district courts with substantial discretion to admit or exclude expert testimony. But even under Daubert, district courts never have discretion to misunderstand or misdescribe the record. Here, that's exactly what happened, mainly because the district court didn't get the full deposition of Dr. Rosenzweig until late in the game. It factually misunderstood the record in two key misunderstood the record.
Well, let me ask you this. Let's break down the orders because I think that's an easier way to look at this. So in order one is the exclusion of the specific causation, and then order two is the denial of the motion to reconsider.
Right.
How in order one, not talking about order two right now, so only order one, how in order one can the district court err or abuse its discretion in misdescribing the record, as you phrased it, when it doesn't have the deposition in front of it?
I'd obviously like to be talking about it when the full deposition.
We'll get there.
This is where I think everybody in the game kind of let the district court down. The MDL transfers the case. I'm getting to your answer. It just takes a little while to get to the answer.
Please get there quick.
Yes. He's got in front of him a motion that attaches excerpts of the deposition, but it doesn't attach the full deposition. I think it was their obligation to not, in the motion, say that there wasn't evidence of stuff when they knew that in the deposition that...
Yeah, but that doesn't go to... Sorry, Judge, are you about to say something? That doesn't go to the district court abusing its discretion. That might go to your opposing counsel not doing what it's supposed to do, and there's other remedies for that. But when we're going to say something very, when we say a district court abuses discretion, it's a big deal. And because that means that there's a wide range of things that could have done, and there's judges all over that could have done stuff within that, and they acted outside of that. And I take that very seriously. And so it just seems to me that, only talking about the first order, that the district court, we can't say that it abuses discretion where it didn't refer to evidence it did not have in front of it.
It's much, much harder if it's possible.
Okay.
It's thin. The things it's got in front of them are several general expert reports, specific expert report, some specific parts of depositions, and then the motion.
So I'm going to ask you a tough question. Do you agree with me that, I think it's page 12 of the specific report regarding Ms. Arvalo, that part was not sufficient in and of itself for I know you guys, the disparate diagnosis, I know you all use a different terminology, and that's fine. But I know, and you're probably right, but I think that ship has sailed, but... that the differential diagnosis, that itself, only looking at that, was not sufficient.
I don't, because it's the difference between the Rule 26 analysis and the Daubert analysis. Daubert analysis is just supposed to be, did you apply a reasonable methodology?
Chapman seems to say, though, that there's three steps to this. Step one, it seems he did comply with, which is list the possible causes. And then step two is you have to eliminate them, but you have to eliminate them with a procedure and giving reasons based on medicine why you would have to do that. And I'm having trouble seeing how this is consistent with Chapman.
Correct. So it's like rule in, rule out.
That's right.
He's definitely ruled it in. I think everybody agrees on that. The ruling out is a little thinner because it just in the report he just says
thin is a nice way to say it. I don't see anything there, and I think that's the problem for you. So let's get beyond that because you probably want to get to the second order.
All right. So at this point, we file a motion for reconsideration. The judge has the full deposition in there, And if I'm the judge, I'm kind of annoyed, not just at the defense counsel, but also not just the plaintiff's counsel, but also the defense counsel. Because like, why didn't you guys give me this before? Like, nobody's helping me out. And like, at this point, it's clear that the differential ideology is completely fleshed out in the deposition.
Well, we'll get there. I'm a little less certain maybe than you are on that, but it's certainly more, but let's get there. Before we get there though, what standard at the reconsideration stage must the trial court apply?
It's not the Rule 59 standard.
Okay. What standard did you tell? And I don't mean you because I know you were not, you're appellate counsel. I know you. I know you were not there at trial. But your client, what did your client tell the district court judge to apply?
We used the language of the Rule 59.
I think it's page 8 or 7 of the motion. How could the district court possibly have abused discretion by applying the standard that you told it to apply?
Right. So to me, as an appellate lawyer, it's obvious that this is the correct standard. It's not the Rule 59 standard. It's an interlocutory order. You apply this other standard. I've been well aware of this, like, authority from our circuit and other circuits that say this. It's an invited error question. I don't think that we invited that error because we were so obviously wrong when we asked the court to...
I think Judge Carnes is laughing because no one has ever made the "it's so wrong that it can't be invited" argument,
I love it.
But it's great to be a first. I will say this, I've done some research. It's not a case that y'all cited to us, and I'm not expecting you to know it, but EEOC versus Smith-Pontiac, 896 F. 2nd, 524. We in almost, not identical, but really close circumstances, dealt with a Rule 60 as opposed to a 59, where the court, same thing, was given the wrong standard. Then on appeal, they said, no, you should have applied this other standard. And we said, we will not reverse this decision because the defendant invited the error. And I'm having trouble with that.
I would say it's akin to like getting like something really fundamental wrong, like the summary judgment standard or like...
Well, okay, so let's talk, let's explore that. I looked at this a lot, and it seems to me as if we have not been as clear-cut as you said. Now, maybe some district courts have done it, but I'll show you again another decision of ours that I'm not sure that either party cited. Region 8 Forest Service Timber Purchasers Council versus Alcock, 993 F. 2nd 800, where we've said, quote, "This court has never explicitly considered the standard of review to be applied to a district court's grant of a motion for reconsideration of a non-final judgment. We've laid out the standard for a final judgment, and then we said, we see no reason to apply a different standard when the party seeks reconsideration of a non-final order." And then we cited that as recently as we've cited in unpublished cases since then that, quote, "We have at least indicated that Rule 54B takes after Rule 60B. Now, I think as a matter of text, that's probably wrong. But how, if there's this question mark out there, how can we expect the district court to have abused its discretion?
May I ask when that prior panel precedent?
Sorry, that was from 1993.
So the oldest case that I cite is...
Was the Fifth Circuit.
And then I think that decision that you're citing from 1993 would be inconsistent with the Fifth Circuit decision. You can't put those things together and have it make sense.
Well, all it's saying, though, is it's unclear. It doesn't hold that this is the standard or not. It's saying that we've never explicitly said it one way or another. I've read the old Fifth Circuit case you said. Even that doesn't quite say this is the standard you apply for interlocutory reconsideration.
Can I ask a follow-up question that I'd like your thoughts on? So is it perhaps that district courts have discretion to determine the standard that they are going to apply to motions to reconsider their own orders that are non-final? So, I mean, if you're a district court, you could say, for example, you know, I'm up to reconsider anything on evidentiary issues to when that evidence comes in on trial, right? I'm willing to reconsider anything. And some other district judge could say, look, I really want this motion in limine process to work really efficiently, and I'm just not gonna reconsider my motion in limine rulings unless there's something extraordinary that happens. I mean, couldn't that standard itself be a discretionary question?
I don't think the standard that's applied is discretionary, and we've kind of got two things going on here because we've got the prior panel precedent problem, and then we also have this potential lurking circuit split with what other circuits have done. The two standards sound kind of close, but the part that's very different is like it's got to be extraordinary. It's got to be unique.
Oh yeah, look. I mean, look. When I was a district judge, I took the position that my motion in limine rulings were completely irrelevant, and we were going to be at trial, and whatever was going to happen at trial was going to happen at trial. But couldn't another district judge say, "I don't want that to happen. I'm going to apply a standard where my motion in limine rulings are the final ruling for me, unless something happens different between now and trial." And why would we as an appellate court tell them this is the standard you must apply for your own evidentiary rulings?
In the example you're giving, you're thinking, I'm not going to reconsider it until some future date and something future is going to happen. Here, like, this is it. Like, this is the end of the, I mean, the order's interlocutory, but it's going to end the case. So you couldn't say it's like final until it's not final. I think under either standard, we still would win, because this is the part about the deposition where it flushes out the differential etiology. And so, like, we agree that, I don't agree, but we've identified the methodology, differential etiology, the methodology. We agree that we've ruled it in because, you know, in the reports and in the deposition, he says she's got extensive fibrosis where the mesh is. And so, then there's a stuff about ruling it out, and I think this is, Judge Luck, what you and I wanted to talk about. Does
but,
it really
but the so let's talk about it. So I let's say that I'm with you with regard to a bunch of the things, including I'm going to pronounce it wrong, but where all these things where one organ goes into another organ, but it still seems to me that there are some things that he didn't raise. Kidney stones, asthma, bipolar disorder, headaches. Now, in your brief, you sort of scoff and say, that's ridiculous. Those things can't possibly cause pain in the pelvic area. But you're a district judge. I know nothing about medicine. When I tell you I know nothing about medicine. And I have a doctor who you're saying is an expert, who's telling me that these are the ruled in possible causes, and then doesn't rule four of them out. So it may seem silly to you, and you know way more than that this than I do, but if he doesn't rule those out and doesn't say a word about them, how can we say he completed the differential etiology?
I think in a way this is the nub of the case, because he's not asked at the deposition about that. And the deposition doesn't go the way I would normally read these types of...
Right, you didn't mean it as an expert affirmative statement of his methodology. This is just a defensive deposition.
Right, so normally what you'd see is like, okay, what did you rule in? I ruled in this, this, and this. Okay, what did you rule out? I ruled out this, this, and this. Why? And then you'd have the answer. Now, the expert report explains that he does rule them out, doesn't say that he, why, and then at the deposition, it's never addressed. And then I'm over the time.
I have a question about something that Judge Luck just said. I mean, so I've read the expert report a couple of different times. I'm not actually sure he does rule in these things. I mean, on the expert report, it just says, here's her medical history. She has bipolar disorder, she has asthma, these things. What do you say about that? Both as a kind of a response to Judge Luck's point that, you know, maybe he didn't rule these out because he never ruled them in, but also, is this a differential etiology that makes any sense, given that there's really nothing on his expert report that rules anything in?
There's two ways of reading that expert report, and I don't know which way is the...
Well, that's a bit of a trick box for you there, because if you answer one way or another, that could be a real problem for you, that question.
Right. So he says the history, he says he did a differential etiology, and he says he still concludes that the mesh was a substantial factor. I think that sentence is stating some stuff is getting ruled in, some stuff may or may not be getting ruled in. He's definitely ruling in the mesh, and then he's definitely ruling out some of this stuff. So what should have happened probably at that point when the defense got the report? They should have said, what do you mean? Like, please give us an amended report that's more clear.
But counsel, if that's all the district court had, at least in the first order, and if he doesn't even meet Chapman step one, the ruling in, then how can we possibly say that there's enough for the district court to have made a conclusion that this is a reliable differential diagnosis?
That's where it's like unclear in that sentence. It might go halfway through the sentence. It might go two-thirds of the way sentence. I don't think there was any argument. It's important to look at what was framed up by the motion and what was responded to. So the motion talks about prior pelvic surgeries, the hysterectomy, the UTIs and the G3P3. We respond obviously without the deposition, and then the order doesn't really seize on any of the arguments that the motion raised. It sua sponte says, well, you never dealt with the rectocele, cystocele, or uterine prolapse. And that was sort of shocking to all the lawyers, I think, because it's like, well, these devices fix that. And he says that in the deposition, like, you know, the devices fix that. And the uterine prolapse, how could it prolapse? Because she doesn't have the uterus.
We've gone over the time, counsel. Thank you, though. Okay. We appreciate it. I know there's a lot to say in the case. Thank you.
May it please the court, Val Leppard for the appellee. I think I'm going to jump straight to order two for just one moment because I've not heard a serious argument that order one is an abuse of discretion under this court's case law in Chapman, Hendricks, and Kilpatrick. When we look at order two, number one, the district court applied the standard that was outlined in the motion for rehearing. At page 7 of 124, which is the motion for rehearing, they point out the standard, which is the exact same standard that the district court applied. But what I would supplement to the discussion is that the district court realized that this was an interlocutory order. That's also on page 7. And it cites this court's decision in Toole versus Baxter Healthcare, which says if it's an interlocutory order, I think Judge Bradford just brought that up about your honors practice when you were on the district court. If it's an interlocutory order, there's plenary power to reconsider it. The court acknowledges that on its own accord, acknowledges it's not cited. It's the citation in the order, which is 141. The court cites Toole versus Baxter Healthcare, which quotes the old Fifth Circuit decision that counsel just brought up. And so it's difficult to fathom an abuse of discretion for failing to apply a standard that was never cited to the district court. The court was fully aware that this was an interlocutory order. And no case they have cited, respectfully, under Rule 54B from this court would hold it an abuse of discretion for failing to consider something that should have been provided but wasn't provided.
Yeah. Let me give you my this is my like best case for the plaintiff's abuse of discretion. So in my view, the plaintiff's best case for abuse of discretion is look, what happened here is the defendant filed a motion that was addressed, that all the lawyers knew what was going on, and the defendant said the reason this expert should be disqualified is because he failed to rule out the hysterectomy. And then the plaintiff responds, addressing why that made sense to rule out the hysterectomy. And then the district court, sua sponte, raises these other issues that I cannot pronounce, sister cell, aviocell, whatever. And then the plaintiff says, oh my gosh, we didn't respond to those, we didn't address those because we had no reason to. And it turns out everybody knows those have nothing to do with this at all. And then so they file a motion for a hearing, and then the district court denies that motion for a hearing saying, you should have given me that before. But the plaintiff says, how were we supposed to know to give it to you before? This wasn't an issue in the defendant's motion. So what do you say about that?
One, when the court reviews our Daubert motion, we relied on Chapman and Hendricks saying it's the burden of the expert to first rule in, to list them all out, and we already said that list is incomplete, right? I mean, we just established, to begin with, the list of ruled in is just a recapture of the medical history, which is incomplete. It doesn't say, for example, that she had pelvic pain going back from when she was 12 or 13 years old. It doesn't talk about the vaginal tears. It doesn't talk about the anal sphincter, the tear of the anal sphincter, the childbirthing injuries that she's had. So that list, to begin with, is incomplete. And then we said it is the expert's burden to come forward and explain, give a scientific and systematic explanation for ruling out. That the district court just picked up an example. This was including, the order doesn't, uses the uterine prolapse, the cystocele and the rectocele as an example. It doesn't say that's the only flaw with that differential diagnosis. It just uses that as an example.
Yeah, but still, I guess, this is mostly for being a devil's advocate, but I mean, how is the plaintiff supposed to know? I mean, so for example, you know, it would seem very odd for the plaintiff to waste the district court's time providing a bunch of evidence to the district court why asthma was ruled out right? The reason the plaintiff is responding to this motion is what you say in the motion, and you don't address, I mean, I've got your motion. I think I'm right about this. Your motion doesn't say anything about these words I can't pronounce. It's all about the hysterectomy, right?
Well, I think we challenged that there was an incomplete diagnosis and an incomplete differential diagnosis. So it's the expert's job and the plaintiff's job to proffer the reliability of the expert's opinion. That is their job, and it's his job to do that in his report. That's what Rule 26 provides. It's not our job to go take his deposition and help him fix the report. That's not our job, nor is it the district court's job to rummage through a deposition that wasn't provided to him to it and try to fix it for the plaintiff. That's not the district court's job. That's the job of Dr. Rosenzweig to begin with, and then plaintiff's counsel to provide it to him. There's not an abuse of discretion to say, I'm unwilling to do that in order. And I want to make sure I answer your question completely, Judge Brasher. When it comes to hysterectomy, the explanation that was given was rebutted by the record. The district court later noted that in document 172. It noted that the explanation that was given for the hysterectomy was rebutted by the record. So that one explanation was false. And then what we have on rectocell and cystocell, the Dr. Khan found a cystocell. She removed part of the exair, the front part of the exair. Now I'm getting really technical, but she removed the front part of the exair, which is supposed to stop the cystocell. So it's actually not automatic to believe that cystocell couldn't appear.
Can I ask a medical question?
Sure.
So I am no expert on any of this stuff, but the what I understand the counter argument to be is, well, she had a hysterectomy, so none of these things could possibly happen or been effective, right? That's the response that they give. How does a hysterectomy have anything to do with cystocell, for example, which is where the bladder falls into the vaginal wall and the vaginal canal? Hysterectomy has nothing to do with that, right?
Exactly right. And what's important here is that Dr. Khan, the explanting physician, found cystocell when she performed the revision.
But what about rectocell? Rectocell, as I understand, is where the rectum sags into the vagina, right?
Correct.
How does that have anything to do with a hysterectomy?
Correct. And on that one, their argument is that, well, you performed the procedure with the Xair device, that should have fixed the rectocell. But they didn't tell the district court that, even in the rehearing motion, okay, this is now getting very detailed, in document 124, the argument was there was an implant with the Aris, which is a whole different device to fix the bladder. So that argument even is to explain to the district court why these things are so obviously wrong. That was incorrect.
Can I fast forward a little bit? I want to go to the Dr. Miklos's testimony. So first of all, do you agree that the factors that we consider in determining whether it was substantially justified or harmless in exercising the sanction here are, first, the explanation given for the fact that it was turned over late, second, the importance of that evidence in the case, and third, the prejudice to the opposing party? You agree those are the factors we consider?
That sounds right. Yeah.
Okay. I think that comes from Beria or Romero and have been applied in other cases since then. So the explanation, as I understand it, from opposing counsel is that, yes, he saw her in July, and yes, he believed that the cause of the pain was the mesh, but that he wanted to, before he rendered an expert opinion, he had the reasonable request of looking through what I imagine is a lot of medical records before doing that. Is that not a reasonable or fair explanation?
So I think in this case, she was aware she had the treatment in July.
Right.
Right. And at that point, as the district court found, she was aware of his opinion.
Right.
And so if he's now going to render an expert report, right, they can put us on notice, or the district court on notice, we need to reopen discovery. Here's a new witness. We need to reopen this. Because as the district court
found, let me ask you this. If they, let's say that had happened, they immediately send a notice and says, we have a new expert witness. Our expert needs about 6 months or 5 months to go through the medical records in order to provide a report. That's what would have happened, right?
That I think they would have applied to the district, right. They would have applied to the district court, and I think that would have been a different analysis at that point.
But that's not an unreasonable explanation, that it would take 5 or 6 months to get a report from a doctor. I imagine you're in this business. The doctors take a long time sometimes to do what they need to do, especially if they're a practicing physician.
I think it's It's not unfair to say for the district judge. It's unreasonable if we're 3 months after summary judgment is fully briefed, if we're 3 years after the expert disclosure deadline, and 8 years after the case was brought.
That may be that goes more to the prejudice part, but I'm talking about the reasonableness of the explanation. That's not an unreasonable explanation to say he saw her, he believes this is the cause, but he wants to run down the medical records to before he renders a medical opinion in court.
But the question is it still has to be substantially justified, though, right?
Well, I'm asking the factors that I thought we agreed and that seemed to come from the case law is right. What the explanation is. Is that not a reasonable explanation, I guess is my question to you.
But not just the explanation has to be reasonable, the actions have to be reasonable. The explanation, there's no reason, as he points out, for not notifying the other side or the district court that we need to halt the trains, that we need to stop the trains, and there's another expert who wants to come into this case. And if they then say in that notice, it takes us 5 months, it takes 6 months, which candidly, you know, there should be an accelerated process if we're in the middle of summary judgment briefing. If they had done that, well, then maybe we're looking at a different case. But the reasonable explanation, it doesn't explain why there wasn't any notification.
The importance factor, I mean, it's this testimony is dispositive. It's why you jumped to file a summary judgment right away on causation. This is the specific causation and getting specific causation evidence was dispositive to this case.
Correct.
So it's important. I mean, you can't dispute that.
No.
Okay. And then the prejudice to the opposing party. What's the prejudice to you? I understand the prejudice to the court, and I might be similarly annoyed that Judge Weatherall was by how this played out. But what's the prejudice to you?
So we're defending hundreds, if not thousands, of mesh cases. We have significant costs that would come about having to take the deposition, reopen discovery, because now we have to give Dr. Miglo's testimony to our experts. We're starting over again, and then we have to have Daubert. We would have filed a Daubert motion on Dr. Miklos had it been allowed. We would have challenged his differential diagnosis, and then we would have rebriefed summary judgment.
But all that would have happened if Dr. Miklos was disclosed earlier. What's the extra? I mean, every one of the steps you just mentioned, other than maybe having to file another summary judgment motion because summary judgment was already briefed, would have happened if they had complied with it being timely. So what I'm having trouble understanding what the prejudice is. What's the increase in prejudice to you by the fact that this happened from what otherwise would have happened?
Well, at some point, we're entitled to finality, too. At some point, we're entitled to know this is the case we're facing. This is the case we have to defend. Here's our summary judgment briefing. We can't go back and back and again have do-over after do-over after do-over because, A, there is a cost associated with it, but also there's an annoyance factor in knowledge of what is our position. If for settlement negotiations, for any of these things, we have hundreds of cases that we're defending, mesh cases, and we can't have one case go back and go back and go back. And as the court put it, it would frustrate the purposes of Rule 26. It would frustrate the orderly disposition of this case. And respectfully, if that were good enough, Your Honor, right, if that explanation on all of the prongs, whether it's the explanation or the substantial justification, if that were good enough, Rule 56 is done.
Yeah. Let me ask you this question. How long was this trial supposed to last? Wasn't it 3 weeks, a three-week trial, something like that? 2 weeks?
I can't swear that usually a mesh case is
yeah. And do you know, I don't know the answer to this question, but do you know whether, so let's say that the district judge had allowed this new expert in, would you have been able to conceivably meet your trial deadline if the new expert had come in?
So the disclosure at that time was only 2 months away from trial. Okay, so yes, this would have presented initially those.
The trial would have had to have been moved, right?
Correct. I would concede this because I don't want to mislead the court. COVID-19 happened in the middle of it, right? So there was a delay.
Didn't the district court, though, say, I thought the district court addressed that and said, even with the, because I think what the district court did is originally the trial date was February or March,
right.
And then I think he set it off to about August or September,
right.
And he said that even that later date would be postponed given what you've laid out, which was opening back up discovery, getting deposition, dueling depositions, doing Daubert motions again, and all that would have even not met that deadline.
There would have been an extra delay. We tried other mesh cases in 2020 at that latter part, you know, in the Middle District of Florida, and I think maybe not a northern district, but yes, there would have been a delay in any event, COVID or not, and it would have added cost, at least to some degree. And that's, you don't get chance after chance after chance after chance. The case was filed eight years ago. She had a chance. She says that Dr. Rosenzweig's the greatest expert ever, right? Essentially, that's the gist of what's being communicated and what was communicated to the district court. It was his burden to get it right. It was his burden to lay it out in his report, not for us to fix it later on in a deposition. And it was their opportunity to present these materials to the district court. And the district court did not abuse its discretion in saying, I'm not going to consider this now when it's belatedly submitted. And you, and this is the one thing I forgot to mention about document 124, which is the motion for rehearing, right? That document never offered an explanation or a justification for not providing the deposition transcript, for making all of these arguments that are out there. And again, the deposition does not explain, even if it were considered, does not explain she had pelvic pain since she was 12 or 13 years old. He doesn't give an explanation what happened to that pain. Why is this pain different now? There's so many things that are not considered, but I know I'm running out of time.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. Thank you.
Judge Brasher, you were asking about this, what I call the crystal ball argument. It's important to keep the motion, each thing that's raised by the different filings in mind. Like you said, the motion just says there are four things that aren't excluded. And then we respond without the deposition, there's a reply, and then the judge raises sua sponte three different things. Now, obviously, we're not required to have a crystal ball to anticipate those kinds of sua sponte rulings. That's the ideal situation where you file a motion for reconsideration. And that's why, one of the reasons why
counsel, it's been granted. Yes. Counsel, let me ask you this. You just said, and kind of surprised me, that you never proffered an explanation for not submitting the deposition originally, you being your side of the case. I understand you weren't in it. Why is that?
Yes. It's not in the record. There's only two things that I've been able to see in the record that you can maybe make some inference. I know that the plaintiff's lawyer's wife was ill at the end of 2019. That's mentioned in a status conference. I think it's Doc 127 or Doc 128, the transcript of that. And then the other reason is the response is actually filed right when COVID is getting hot. It's beginning of March 2020, and those are the only two things that I can think of why this wasn't done correctly. I don't.
But you never proffered to the district court that or any other reason, correct?
I don't believe so. It's not, I don't.
Well, you see that makes it almost impossible to hold an abuse of discretion as to order one. It really does. I guess that's a question. But you can proceed with your argument regardless.
Can you address can you talk about the Dr. Michalos testimony briefly?
Dr. Michalos testimony. So I think the prejudice just isn't there. The trial, as I understood it, was 10 months off. And
the district judge, am I wrong? The district judge fine in the order where he ultimately excluded it, that it would affect that trial date, even the one far off, right?
I don't recall.
We can go look. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But
I don't
okay.
recall that. But I know it was long off, and all of these things would have happened, had to happen anyways, even if the doctor had delivered the report on the same day that he saw, Mrs. Arevalo. I think that mostly covers it, unless...
thank you. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. We're adjourned for the day. All right.